KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
...of the University of Washington.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Dams on the Elwha River are coming down, but that hasn't ended controversy over how to restore the river and its native ecosystem. Seattle Times reporter Linda Mapes has been covering the Elwha for years. She's our guest later this hour. And it's Tuesday, and it feels like summer, even if it's not summer yet. It's a perfect time to turn your mind to gardening. Our panel of experts will be here about 10:30 to take your calls. Yesterday, Snohomish County Sheriff John Lovick traded in his badge to be sworn in as the county executive. He replaces Aaron Reardon, who left office Friday after a series of scandals. Snohomish County Executive John Lovick joins us this morning. Hello.
Good morning, and it's good to be on.
And congratulations. I'm delighted to hear that. Congratulations on your new job. Let's just start right in. Your county, despite all the scandals at the top post, Snohomish County's been on an economic upswing, and I'm curious as to your plans to keep that momentum going.
Well, you are correct. It has been, and I'm pleased to see that. As you will probably know that the unemployment rate is down to 4.9%. We'd like to get that down to zero. And what we're going to do is we're going to, the first thing I'm going to do is recognize the great work that's being done by everybody in county government, and they are the reasons that we're having such success. And engage the business community. I plan to be the face of county government. We're going to welcome businesses to this county. And to do that, you just have to be out there engaged and involved. And I plan to do that.
When you were interviewed by Snohomish County Council members, you said one of your biggest priorities was to change the tone and tenor of Snohomish County government. What's the first step to making that happen?
The first step is what I did yesterday. I tell people that I have an MBWA, which is management by walking around. You walk around, you get out into the community. I spent probably 2 hours yesterday going to the different departments, talking to them, and I was pleased with what I saw. You need to recognize that they are the ones doing the bulk of the work. They are the ones, good people coming to work every day doing great things, and I'm going to talk about them. I'm not going to talk about me. It's going to be about them. And that's where you change the tone. You change the tone by reaching out to county council members. One county council member has been in my office this morning, and he said, I've never been in this office. I was here once in 5 years. I've invited other council members, but I'm also going to get out of the office and go visit them. People need to know that they have a government that works, a functioning government. And that's the way you change the tone and tenor.
Well, I think people can tell, County Executive Lovick, from your voice that you are not a native of the Northwest. I believe you're from Louisiana, but you have lived in Snohomish County for more than 35 years. And I'm wondering, from that experience as a resident, let alone a government official, what you see as the biggest priorities?
I think the biggest priority with respect to government, and I say this all the time, and I want to say it again, jobs, jobs, jobs. Mm-hmm. We need jobs in this area. We need jobs in this region. We need to go out to Boeing and convince them to build that 777 here. We need to go to those employers and say, bring your business here. So I'm going to say jobs, 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 jobs. That's what we're going to focus on.
Now, you mentioned Boeing, and of course that is, I believe, the largest employer in your county, if I'm not mistaken. And how can you convince them? We've been watching them move jobs to South Carolina, move engineering jobs, move the IT jobs. What would convince them to stay here?
First of all, they need to know that this is a good place to do business. It's a great place to do business. They are the largest employer. We need to work with not only our congressional delegation, we need to work with our legislators, our governor. When our governor was here, I think less than a month ago, unfortunately, and I love the governor, but this is Snohomish County. We need to get him in. He is engaged, but I need to be standing right next to the governor. And we need those employers, Boeing and all of those large employers, to know that we are working together to create a great business environment, a great business climate for them.
Does that include various tax incentives?
Those are things that we need to talk about, and we need to never stop talking about those things, because my feeling about it is whatever we need to do to keep them here, we need to do it. We need to reach out to them. And if there are tax incentives on the table, I think that's fine.
You spent most of your career in law enforcement. You were a state trooper before you became sheriff. How does that influence the way that you'll approach this new job?
Well, I was a state trooper for 31 years.
It's a long time.
It was a very, very disciplined, structured agency. I think the discipline helped a lot. The discipline with being on time, treating people with respect, being respectful, demanding respect for myself. I think that influences a lot. I'm a person, and sometimes to my own fault, I'm a person with a fair amount of confidence in myself, and I learned that growing up in Louisiana. And so I think when people see that I tell them that I'm going to do something, I am going to do it. I tell them that I'm going to be somewhere at a certain time, I will be there. And I think those things make a difference.
One of the things that we have heard a lot about in the past decade, if not more, is regional intergovernmental cooperation. And I'm wondering, from your perspective, what areas do you think could benefit from strong alliances between Snohomish and King, Pierce, Kitsap, or even Skagit counties, Whatcom County, to the north of you?
You know, to start with, it's when you just start with just the concept of transportation, with light rail and all of those things. We need to have the counties work together. We need to look at having a good transportation plan in place. When we're talking about light rail, sound transit, those are the things that we need to communicate about. I actually talked with a congressman one day, and he kind of shared with me that, you know, they need to be at the table. We need to communicate with them, and all of us need to be at the table on a lot of issues, transportation being right at the top of the list.
I know that you served some time in the state legislature, which is, at this point, as far as I know, still deadlocked when it comes to what the budget will be. Do you consider yourself in this new role to be a lobbyist for Snohomish County when it comes to the state legislature?
I would say a lobbyist, if you will. And also, I want to be an ambassador, the same type of ambassador that our county employees, the role that they serve in every single day. I want them to know that I'm in Olympia, I'm out in the community doing things to try and bring projects, not only transportation projects, to bring jobs, opportunities to Snohomish County. So yes, if you want to use the word lobbyist, that's fine. But I also like to refer to the word a good ambassador for this county. I've only been here for like less than 24 hours.
But you seem like you're out there. And what I hear you saying in this conversation that we're having right now is that you want to be far more visible than your predecessor has been, which leads me to wonder if this you have done a lot of public service in addition to being a state trooper and then a sheriff. Did you always harbor aspirations for higher office?
You know, when you always think that if there are opportunities. I loved serving on the Mill Creek City Council because I always refer to city council members, local county officials as the foot soldiers of democracy. But you also see different opportunities. And when the opportunity came for me to be able to serve in the legislature, yes, I stepped up to the plate. I had hoped I was possibly going to run in 2015 after the former executive was term limited. So yes, you always want to move up and do more if you can and contribute more if you have the opportunity to do so.
I just need to ask a little detour of a question. Over the weekend, there was a horribly sad shooting of a 15-year-old girl in Lake Stevens, something that I understand is very unusual for that neighborhood. And I don't know if you still have your sheriff hat on when you think about that particular crime, but I know that crime prevention was something that you really thought about as sheriff.
Yes, it was a horrible situation. I don't know a lot of details. I know I'm referring to my position as sheriff. I know the Snohomish County Sheriff's Office's major crimes unit is investigating it, and I don't know the details, but it's just a sad situation because from what I understand, she was an outstanding 15-year-old girl who was doing just what you want young kids to do, get engaged in their community, staying in school, getting a good education. So it's just a very, very tremendously sad time and a sad thing to have had happen.
I know that as sheriff, you were involved in helping set up a gang prevention program. Is there any evidence that this crime was gang-related?
Nothing that I have been told, and I'm not being briefed on the case at the moment, but from what I understand, I have not had any indication that it's gang-related. And I'll tell you what, we've done a great job addressing the gang problem in Snohomish County. I'm very, very pleased with some of the things that we have done. You can drive through Snohomish County, and it's a tremendously safe county. And I always tell people this, that you can have all of the things in the world. If you can't have a safe community, it's going to be hard to get people to participate, to get people to engage your community if they don't feel safe. And what we try to do, what I try to do as sheriff, I told people all the time that we can't guarantee your safety, but we should do everything we can to guarantee that you feel safe, that you feel safe going to a ballpark, that you feel safe walking down the street going to the store. So we feel very, very good about some of the things that we have done with respect to gang suppression in Snohomish County.
I assume as county executive, you now supervise the sheriff's office. You're the boss of them all.
I'm kind of the leader of Snohomish County government, and I'm so pleased, honored, and humbled to be in this position.
This is a temporary appointment. Do you plan on running for a full term after this appointment expires?
Absolutely. Full speed ahead for me. I plan to run in 2014.
Yep.
I plan to run again in 2015. Kind of unusual. I've not run 2 years in a row in a long time. But it's the process. It's the way our democracy works, and I'm looking forward to it.
Well, County Executive Lovick, we wish you good luck on your new job.
Thank you, and have a good rest of the day and a wonderful show.
Thank you. John Lovick is the new Snohomish County Executive. Talk to us here on Weekday on KUOW.
It's 9:19. Traffic trouble in Renton, I-405 southbound, just past State Road 167. Still pretty jammed up thanks to an accident earlier this morning. The Department of Transportation says drivers should avoid the area and take alternate routes, such as westbound I-90 to I-5 or State Road 18 to I-5. Now, if you're stuck in a music listening rut, we're going to get you unstuck. Hang on, that's just moments away right after a look at the weather and one of these.
Support for KUOW comes from the Champion Window and Sunroom Company, manufacturing and installing custom factory direct windows since 1953. Champion Windows help keep homes warm in winter, cool in summer, and quiet year-round. In-home consultation and product and warranty information at getchampion.com/Seattle.
64 degrees in Seattle, expecting to reach 77 this afternoon with lots of sun. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:20. An in-depth look at the huge historic dam removal project on the Elwha River in about 15 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Are you stuck in a music listening rut? Well, we have started a new series here on Weekday that we hope will help widen your musical horizons. And today, we welcome music journalist Michelle Duma-Levasseur to the studios. And Michelle, I'm going to have you move in a little
sure.
bit closer to the microphone. You're going to talk about women of Northwest music, past and present, but future too?
Yes, that's correct. I'm going to be profiling next week in Seattle Weekly 50 of the most influential women in Seattle music.
Wow.
It's kind of a testament to our scene that we can whittle it down to 50, you know, that we had to kind of condense those women.
Where are you starting?
In every field. Video directors, photographers, musicians, of course, people who work in production, just the general field. There's a wide range of women doing a lot of interesting things in Seattle music right now.
Well, that's exciting. You have brought... Maybe I want to start with this because we're in the middle of the Seattle International Film Festival. But
yes.
Speaking of influential women, before we hear some music, there's a new documentary about the prototypical riot girl, Kathleen Hanna,
yes.
Bikini Kill. And you saw...
I did, and we'll be listening, I believe, to her in just a little bit. We're going to talk about La Tigre and her second band. Because whereas Bikini Kill is part of a movement,
mm-hmm.
and at that time, a lot of female musicians were using punk in different pockets of the country to kind of channel their message. La Tigra is something else. She kind of reinvents a genre of music and kind of sets a precedent for what the new millennium is going to sound like.
Okay, so everybody stay tuned. We're going to hear that. Where do you want to start?
Let's start with We Are Loud Whispers, which is a record that came out last month on local label Hardly Art. It's a Sub Pop subsidiary. And the woman involved in that project, Sonia Westcott, was also in Hardly Art's first band that they signed called Arthur and You. And she's a really interesting musician. I don't know if you...
Well, let's hear some.
Yeah.
So what I'm hearing is sort of a mix, it sounds like, with a sort of electronics mixed in with just some nice instrumentals.
Yeah, we're going to hear her very ethereal vocals kick in here. And what I like best about Sonia is she does interesting collaborations. Her first project, Arthur and You, she pairs up with a gentleman, Grant Olson, who is learning how to make records in his bedroom by listening to Lee Hazelwood. And she's like, all right, you figure that out. I'll come in. I'll lay down some interesting vocals. When it comes in, I believe we have a sample of that, too. She kind of takes her voice in these interesting places that can be very ethereal. To some places, they're kind of haunting in a Twin Peaksy way. If you know Julie Cruz, she kind of has that kind of soft voice that she can really use as an interesting instrument.
So this We Are Loud Whispers is another collaboration for
her? Yes, this is her second collaboration, her second record on Hardly Art. She just kind of chooses people she wants to work with in a really interesting manner. She is, for this record, working with, I'm going to pronounce this correctly, Ayumi Hatani. In Japan, and they make records similar in a manner to the Postal Service, where they send tracks back and forth.
Really?
And just keep working on them until they feel like they're complete. So it's a really, you know, interesting way to make music in the digital age, and it really has no barrier. He can bring in interesting sounds that are happening in Japan. She lays down, you know.
And they just send them back and forth and layer them?
Yeah.
So do we have one of those tracks to listen
yes,
to?
Yes, the one we were listening to, and then I believe it'll be the third. This is Arthur and You with Grant Olson, and then we can hear a little bit of her on the next track. This is that first release, and then the next one we're going
to hear called... Yeah, let's just skip right to number three.
Yeah, to Glossalia, which is a DJ's nightmare to produce, but a really beautiful track to listen to. You can see her. She kind of uses these tiny little inflections in her voice that really are special.
So this is just her overdubbed on herself vocally, or is this?
Yeah, I believe they layer her vocals and all the process. But she can sing in a lot of different ranges and a lot of different parts and kind of play with her vocal styling.
I like that. It is sort of a filmy sort of sound.
And it's something I think Hardly Art is kind of known for pushing music in an edgy direction. They have artists like Grave Babies and Fergus and Geronimo that are really avant-garde. And to me, this is probably their most commercial sounding effort. Like, you could give this to your dad for Father's Day and he would be very interested in it. And I also like Hardly Art a lot because it's run by a young woman, named Sarah Moody. And I believe she is still under 30.
And so Sonia, and Sonia's also young, Sonia Westcott?
I am not sure of Sonia's age, but she is youngish.
Well, we'd heard last from We Are Loud Whispers, which is Sonia Westcott's project, Suchness.
Suchness.
Suchness on Hardly Art Records, in collaboration with a partner in Japan.
Yes, across the water. And speaking of other young women who are doing interesting things, Katie Kate is a local rapper and beat master, and she is 26 and nominated this year for a Stranger Genius Award.
Wow.
And I think if we can just start listening to Katie. This is a track I had to go through and edit out the decent bleeping. She is a rapper. Yeah, she's got a very distinctive flow. It's very, very quick.
Did she speed this up?
No, if you hear her live, she goes that quick. She goes as quick as the boys. She's She's a voice to be reckoned with. I think her flow is really what's distinctive about her, and also the fact that she is working, you know, from the beats up. A lot of female musicians, even rappers, don't produce their own beats to start with, and that makes Katie kind of a special.
Well, I know, Michelle, that we have a real burgeoning hip-hop scene here anyways. I think people know the Northwest historically is more of a sort of dark, garagey rock kind of place. But it seems maybe the last 5 to 10 years, you know, Macklemore and Ryan Lewis are sort of the commercial pinnacle. But really that this hip-hop scene is where the young artists are coming from.
It's definitely a different angle of the Seattle music scene. And I would say really within the last 5 years, there's a record by a band called Mad Rad, or an act called Mad Rad, called White Gold, that I think kind of is the shift in, you know, you can hear a lot of them in Macklemore and that kind of more commercial sound, whereas bands before that, Blue Scholars or Common Market or Source of Labor, had a very kind of distinctive Seattle sound. They make things sound a little more commercial, a little more edgy. They blend in, you know, kind of like some London House sounds.
Well, I'm also was thinking, listening to Katie Cade of The Satisfaction,
yes,
duo that
absolutely
we've had in, and just wonderful young women.
Yes, they have their own message. They also are very hands-on in what they produce and how they work. And, you know, they have a very specific, like, political agenda that they're accounting for with their music, whereas Katie kind of takes it all over the map.
Do we have another track of Katie Kate?
We have a track, I believe, called Drift that we're going to play next. That's kind of where she kind of slows her flow and gets into more like a Grimes electronic area. So, yeah, you can kind of feel it's very smoothed out.
And what label is she recording on?
Well, right now, that's Katie is looking for a label. It's kind of the problem with modern technology. You can make a beautiful, perfect record and have, and what are we going to do with it? She's part of the Out for Stardom collective with some of the guys from Mad Rad. Mm-hmm. And they put out her last record, but I think right now they're really looking for something to garner her more national attention.
It's, listen up, record label.
Yeah, I know, exactly. Well, sign Katie Kate.
Yeah, but so essentially you have to buy her online if you want to.
What we're listening to now isn't available. I believe she has one track. This is brand new. She has one track, I believe, on Bandcamp that you can access from this record.
But otherwise?
Otherwise, it will be a little while before you get to hear this. I'm sure, you know, it'll filter out on KEXP and whatnot. In my dream scenario, the Macklemore camp puts this out.
Okay.
Because obviously they know how to put out independent music, and that would be great. I think it'd be great for everybody involved, but that's just me talking. That's not, don't start that rumor, please.
Oh, well, you just said it on the radio, Michelle.
Yeah,
so, any more Katie Kate to listen to her?
Yeah, I would like to, we've got one last track where she really goes in this kind of very mainstream dancey kind of. It's called Sadie Hawkins, and we'll just play a little bit of that.
Here's Katie Kate.
This is very accessible. You could hear it on like the Girls soundtrack, you know.
I like it a lot.
Yeah, it's really good. And I think you know, for someone who makes their own beats, I think you can really trace her back to Kathleen Hanna, who, you know, we're going to talk about here in a second, and her work with the Tigre. So
let's hear just a little bit more of Katie Kate. Well, I have to say, Michelle, that really suits summer.
Yeah. It would be great if this could be your summer jam.
Let's
get this record out, people.
So this is it. You've heard it here. So let's jump back in time to the foremother of Katie Kate, if you will, Kathleen Hanna, who you mentioned. New documentary film about her that screened at Seattle International Film
the
Festival.
Punk singer.
If you don't know who Kathleen Hanna is, in a nutshell, really quickly.
She is a woman involved with the Riot Girl movement in Olympia. She kind of took her inclination for making zines and that kind of meticulous nature and put it into sampling in her record between Bikini Kill and La Tigre called Julie Rune, which is kind of a bedroom record where she figures out how to use electronics to kind of convey her message.
And so we're going to listen to Kathleen in her La Tigre era.
Yes. This song is from her 1999 debut. To me, it really is the song that defines the new millennium of music. I was a club kid, like a punk rock club kid, when this track came out before the record. And this is what they call in the hip-hop vernacular, the jump-off.
The like, jump-off?
The second this came on, the club would just explode.
But this, to me, sounds like quintessential Northwest music of 90s and aughts.
But it also blends things like the Ramones and Devo with that Riot Girl aesthetic, and also just being able to electronically take that whole process into your hands. There's not a, you know, a big studio involved. You're not bringing in other musicians. She's kind of working on everything integrally in her own way, and I think you can hear that now. And even people like Iconopop or Grimes, or who kind of work in that same methodology. And I also think it's incredibly influential in that this record by La Tigre in 1999 predates the LCD sound system by about 6 years. And most people consider danceable, like sociological pop to be James Murphy's baby. But to me, I was living in New York when that LCD sound system record came out, and I explained to people, no, it's basically La Tigre for straight white guys. That is what LCD is.
Well, we're going to go out with Kathleen Hanna, I believe, because we've run out of time.
Yes.
So much fun. Music journalist Michelle Duma-Levasseur has been with us talking a little bit about Women of Northwest Music, past, present, and Katie Cade is the future. And
yes,
you can read more about this next week in Seattle Weekly.
Yes, and also EMP will be doing their Women in Rock exhibit, I believe, which opens on the 12th, and I would encourage everyone to go check that out.
So we go out here on Weekday with a little music from Kathleen Hanna.
Music from Kathleen Hanna on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. It's 9:33. A close look at the historic Elwha River Dam Removal Project in a minute.
The river is it, the beginning of his adventure. And here at the final place, he stops for the last time. Everything has led up to this moment.
I'm Jane Curtin. This week on Selected Shorts, Time Travel, from PRI, Public Radio International.
Short stories read on the radio tonight at 10 o'clock.
KUOW and the Fry Art Museum present Buster Simpson, Surveyor, a retrospective exhibition of work by Seattle artist Buster Simpson, a pioneer in the field of environmental and public art that provokes civic awareness and dialogue, June 15th through October 13th. More on the events page at KUOW.org.
65 degrees in Seattle. It is sunny. It's going to stay sunny, and they say we're going to hit 77 this afternoon.
Support for KUOW comes from UW Medicine Obstetrics. The UW Medicine Obstetrics Program helps women have healthy pregnancies and healthy babies through its comprehensive family-based approach, including midwifery, lactation support, genetic counseling, or high-risk care. More information at uwmedicine.org/obstetrics.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. The Elwha River comes roaring out of the Olympic Mountains and runs toward the Strait of Juan de Fuca. Well, once upon a time, the Elwha River roared out of the mountains. For most of the 20th century, the flow was blocked by two dams, the Elwha and the Glines Canyon. Now, after decades of political fighting, the dams have almost all come down, and environmentalists, scientists, and Native Americans in the area hope the Elwha and its ecosystem will come roaring back. Seattle Times reporter Linda Mapes has spent years covering the fight to remove the dams and now the Elwha's reestablishment as a habitat for fish and the ecosystem that has grown up around the fish run. With her colleague, photographer Steve Ringman, Linda Mapes has published her work in a new book called Elwha, River Reborn, and she joins us in the studios. Hi, thanks for coming in.
Good morning, Marcy. It's great to be here.
I do have to ask this because I can't remember. How long have you been covering the Elwha River?
Well, since 1996. I actually first started going out there for the Spokesman Review. So like a lot of people in the Northwest, this is a story that's been going on in my life for a long, long time.
Take us back in time to the construction of that first dam. When was that?
1910. And this all started with Thomas Aldwell, actually a Canadian, who arrived in Port Angeles to do what a lot of guys were doing back then, make his fortune from the natural resources that were there, to his mind, just waiting for someone like him to show up.
And so he wanted to make a mill. He wanted the power from the water.
Exactly. Port Angeles, back then, there wasn't a lot going on. And he looked around and he saw all the trees and he saw the deep water port protected, a natural port, by the Eddis Hook, and thought, add cheap power and you've got a booming economy. And he was right. With the Elwha Dam, he brought electricity to the Olympic Peninsula. And with the cheap power came the mill industry that powered the economy of Port Angeles and the peninsula for decades.
What was the Elwha and that area like before this?
Spectacular. Home to every run of native steelhead and salmon, there was always something in the Elwha River, either migrating upstream or downstream every single month of the year, home to all five species of Pacific salmon as well as other fish. It was an absolutely abundant river and home to the very largest species of Chinook salmon in Puget Sound, the Elwha Tai'i, which, if left alone to grow big over 7 years in the ocean, can reach even 100 pounds of size.
You know, you have talked to people who heard stories about walking across the river on the backs of the salmon. That's something you hear about the Columbia River as well. Did you actually meet anybody who saw that firsthand?
I met Adeline Smith. Adeline passed away at age 95 just about 2 months ago. But when I first met her back in 1996, and really, all the way to the end, her memories remained clear and sharp of the Elwha. She was born between the construction of the two dams, so she knew the river when it was still absolutely alive with fish. She used to tell me stories about when she was a little kid. She would swim in the Elwha River and feel the fish actually bumping her as she swam.
So in the period where first the Elwha Dam and then the Glines Canyon were constructed, what became of those fish runs?
Well, when you block passage completely, as the Elwha Dam did, illegally, by the way, what happens is you're constraining those adult fish coming back to only the lower 5 miles of the river. And so they're packed into a much smaller area. They were denied 70 miles of spawning habitat above the dam. Not only that, but you are changing the entire regime of the river. No longer are you getting that flow of sediment and gravel downstream, which the fish need in order to build their nests. The river is also greatly simplified in its complexity. You don't have those side channels and all of those habitats that the fish need. And water temperature is a problem. When you impound water and it bakes in the sun, it gets warmer. And it used to happen that below the lower dam, you would have to do these rescues in August when the big kings would come back and they would reach this pool at the lower dam where they would still try to go up. And they would actually strike themselves against the dam trying to go where they could not go.
That in 1910, I'm assuming there were no laws requiring fish ladders or passageways back up to spawning grounds, correct?
That's actually not true.
Really?
We like to comfort ourselves thinking, oh, they didn't know what they were doing. Actually, Thomas Aldwell and the fisheries commissioner at the time knew exactly what they were doing, which was breaking the law. And you can read this for yourself in the state archives and in the death rattle of the onion skin paper. You can read the death warrant for the Elwha River. Here's what they did. The fisheries commissioner and Thomas Aldwell struck a deal in which they decided that they would break the law on the books, since even the territorial legislature that, and I quote, you must have a fish ladder whenever fish are want to ascend. I've read it for myself in the leather-bound volumes in the state archives. It's right before something about dairy cattle. So it was against the law to build a dam without a fish ladder, and they knew it. But they struck this deal in which the state decided Thomas Aldwell's dam could be the obstruction for the state's hatchery. So this was the beginning of what would be a 100-year policy of swapping out hatcheries for native habitat. And so he built his dam with the explicit deal that he would not have to build a fish ladder. And I still remember the wording in the letter from the Fisheries Commissioner. Here's what he said, and I quote, this you'll find will eliminate all bother in the future, end quote.
Eliminate all bother in the future. We're talking with Seattle Times reporter Linda Mapes, who has been covering the Elwha River for almost 20 years now, from most of the fight to remove the dams. And at this was traditionally, and a lot of the land belonged to the Elwha Klallam tribe whose home this was. This was prior to the Bolt decision that they ceded the land. So essentially, once they ceded the land as a tribe, they had no recourse to protest legally this dam construction, right?
That's absolutely true. And when you talk to people at the Lower Oaklallam tribe, which, by the way, is a small tribe, we're talking about 1,000 people today and only about 400 of them live on the reservation. This isn't a big casino tribe. They have a casino, but it's kind of tucked away off the highway. And so you're talking about a tribe that really found itself on its own for many, many years, always wishing these dams hadn't been built, always bearing the brunt of the loss of the fishery. They didn't even get electricity on the res, by the way, until about 1965. So, you know, they paid the most and got the least. And it wasn't until the modern era when the dam, Lyons Canyon Dam, came up for relicensing. Remember, the lower dam was never licensed.
Right.
It came relicensing time, and by that time, regulations had changed. Times had changed, and it was going to be impossible for the owner of those dams, Daishawa Pulp Mill, a Japanese-owned firm, to get a license. They just couldn't afford to do the kind of fixes that they were going to have to do. People always forget this history. The fact is, dam removal was a rescue for the city of Port Angeles. It was a rescue for a private pulp mill operator who basically got a gift from the taxpayers of America, who bought these two deadbeat dams that couldn't even be licensed for $30 million. They didn't have to pay for the restoration costs. They even got paid to take these dams off their hands and gave them replacement power from the Bonneville grid. So the pulp mill could still keep chuffing along, paying very important wages to workers at the mill. That mill still runs today, more than 90 years after it was first built, by the way, with the power from the Elwha Dam.
Who brokered that deal?
Congress and a bunch of lobbyists. And one of my favorite quotes in the book is, this thing was done by a bunch of lobbyists on a golf course. It was done in the middle of the night. It was the last bill passed during the legislative session. And when it passed, the people in Port Angeles were shocked and amazed. They couldn't believe that this was actually going to happen. And then you were in the very odd situation of the pulp mill actually trying to sell this deal to the locals, who were very attached to those dams that had stood for so long and stood for the taming of nature and the rigging of an economy. And so, oddly enough, you had sort of the downtown business community trying to sell this thing to the locals who didn't understand what a bailout this truly was. And even today, there's a sentiment that lingers. How could you unplug two perfectly good dams is kind of how it goes. And it's often forgotten that this actually was a bailout for the local economy. It was very important that those jobs be saved, and the only way it was going to happen was going to be with replacement power and getting rid of the dams, because they couldn't be economically relicensed.
How was this dam? I know that we don't see a lot of dam removals at all in the United States, but this particular project, the removal of these two dams, is exciting for scientists in a particular way that other restoration of rivers is not.
This is the largest dam removal project ever anywhere in the history of the world. And the reason for that, it's twofold. Number one is the sheer geographic scale of the thing. We're talking about a 326 square mile watershed, three quarters of it already protected forever within the Olympic National Park and never wrecked, which means you take out the dams and you have the incredible gift of this already mostly perfect place that's now going to be made even better. It's not like so many projects where you're trying to make a small little part within a larger destroyed landscape a little bit better. This is different. I mean, this is truly a mountains-to-sea restoration. It's big. The other thing that makes it the largest restoration ever is the amount of sediment.
I was going to ask you, because one of the things that I recall hearing when the first dam came down was the surprise of folks. They hadn't planned for how much sediment there was going to be.
Interesting thing about that. You know, mistakes have a way of living on in records, and that's what happened here. There were some old maps that had numbers on them that just kind of never were right in the first place and got passed on down the information chain. And so there was an underestimate of how much sediment was going to have to be managed when you take down these dams. Mm-hmm. such that it's now been revised upward to 34 million cubic yards of sediment. We're talking about gravel, silt, sand, mud, 100 years worth of material that normally would have rinsed down from the high mountains to the salt water and distributed all throughout the 45-mile run of the river. Boy, no, most of it, in fact, right now, is still stuck behind Glynn's Canyon Dam. And it's a lot of material. It is every reason why this is going so slowly. You can't just blow and go, as we did on Condit, bang, gone in an hour, literally.
Mm.
You can't do that with the Elwha. There's just too much sediment. You can't subject the downstream world to a mudslide. So it's been this take it down 10 feet at a time thing.
How much of the Glynn's Canyon Dam has been removed at this point?
Three quarters of it. We're down to the last 60 feet. And this is a time to tell people that there's some bad news on the Elwha, which is that dam removal actually is on hold. And it has been since last October.
Why?
Well, there's a water plant, a very expensive water plant that was built as part of the mitigation for the dam removal so that downstream users would have pretreated water for industrial processes, remove some of the sediment from the water before it was used by the municipal water plant, by that same pulp mill, and some other users. The water plant doesn't work. It actually choked in the first fall rains. It's managing less than 10% of the amount of sediment it was supposed to be able to manage. It just doesn't work. And so the Park Service, which is managing the restoration, has called in contractors. The dam removal contractors are sitting on the sidelines waiting to get back to their job while other contractors have come in to try to fix it.
Who's paying for all this?
That would be us.
The other issue that you write about in the book and that has continued is you mentioned hatchery salmon at the get-go in 1910 with this original deal. I know that there still is controversy over whether there's a pure return of the native fish runs or whether the hatchery fish who have been bred for a century should continue or to be released into the water. So where do we stand on all of that?
The use of a hatchery was the single most controversial piece of the Elwha restoration. There is a hatchery. It's a $16 million hatchery, a brand new hatchery built as part of this restoration. And there were a lot of scientists and a lot of native fish advocates who were deeply disappointed not to be able to see the Elwha be a living laboratory for a natural recovery. That is to say, let nature take its course. Let these fish find their way back to the river and gradually find their way into the upper watershed. But that didn't happen here.
Why not?
There are two reasons for that. One is, you know, it's not actually just a living laboratory. It's also the homeland of the Lower Elwha Klallam tribe with a treaty right to fish. And while some of us might be perfectly happy to sit and wait for 20 years or perhaps longer for enough fish to be restored to the river to have a fishery for the tribe, they've already been waiting 100 years. And so they wanted some assurance that there would be fishable runs of salmon sooner than that. So the tribe wanted to see some hatchery fish. Number two, you know, three of the runs on the Elwha today are listed under the Endangered Species Act, and they are so depleted, you're literally down to a couple hundred native steelhead at this time, wild steelhead. And the concern was if you have these conditions in the river, which we will, a very, very high sediment loading, you might lose those fish. And so the desire and the actual legal requirement under the ESA was to have the hatchery as a safe harbor for some of those fish. So what's going on is called a jump start, if you will. That is outplanting of native Chinook and Coho into the river to try to get recovery going a little bit faster. Jim Likatowicz, who wrote the beautiful book Salmon Without Rivers, said one of the funniest quotes to me in the book, which was, you know, the Elwha is not a dead battery. It doesn't need a jump start. It's a wild river. Just let it do its thing. Mm. But, you know, that's not what's happening. There will be a hatchery. It's operating now. Outplanting is happening. The Elwha is a grand experiment. We'll see if in the end that was the right choice or not. The concern is that hatchery fish can deplete the health and the robustness of the wild fish. They compete with them. There's always the possibility of introgression and disease. But the thing that was of the greatest concern has been eliminated, which was planting of non-native steelhead in the river. This is something the tribe had suggested early on, again, so that they would have something to catch that's not listed on the endangered species list. Mm-hmm. But there was so much concern about the potential of out-of-basin steelhead interbreeding with native stocks, even though, by the way, they've been stocking that non-native fish for, gosh, I want to say 20, 25 years. that in the end, the tribe decided not to do that. The non-native steelhead at the hatchery were destroyed or planted in a lake without any outlet to the Elwha. So while there is a hatchery being used, those are native fish stocks that are being planted.
Even though the Glines Canyon Dam removal has halted because of all this sediment and the water purification, you have still seen and you have documented in this book the return of some of the ecosystem that had disappeared when everything was stopped up artificially. And, you know, just as we end this interview, are scientists optimistic that what we're going to see is maybe not the wild Elwha as it was, but a wild river reborn?
No question. It's already happening. And it's one of those times when, while people have stumbled with this water plant, it's important to keep in perspective everything that's going right with the Elwha. It's historic. You've never seen a restoration on this scale, and it's already successful. Fish are storming back into that watershed, going all the way up into the Olympic National Park, all the way up to the foot of Glines Canyon Dam. They're going into those side channels, which aren't full of sediment, so they can use them, and they are. Not only that, but when you walk on these former lake beds, they're covered with tracks, animal tracks. Animals are already reusing this place. Revegetation is taking hold. There's stuff growing higher than your head, especially closest to the native forest where there's been a lot of seed rain that's helping get that going. It's most incredible, I think, to go down to the beach because, to me, this documents the true sweep of this restoration. 3 years ago, if you walked on that beach at the river mouth, you'd be turning your ankle on bare cobble. You talk to elders at the tribe, and they tell you stories about gathering clams, and you think, boy, really, that's hard to imagine. You walk that beach today, it's soft sand. That's that sediment finally coming back down from the high mountains, replenishing the Elwha truly from the mountains to the sea.
Makes me want to take a trip out there to see it. Linda Mapes is a reporter for the Seattle Times, and with her colleague, photographer Steve Ringman, she's published with Mountaineers Press, Elwha, A River Reborn. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you, Marcy.
This is Weekday. It's a beautiful Tuesday, and if you're not going out to the Elwha, it's surely time to think about getting into the great outdoors somewhere. Michael Fagan joins us once again with a weather outlook and a hike recommendation. A lot nicer than last week, Michael.
That's right. A lot of complaints last week, so things are...
So you fixed it for us.
Well, I don't know. I put a request, and someone listened to us. We're looking at Tuesday through at least Thursday. Plenty of sun, highs in the mid-70s, so great time to go out. Might get some clouds on Friday and perhaps some drizzle on the coast. I don't think we'll get drizzle here, and then back to the sun over the weekend. So we have a nice stretch of weather. And this hike is Easton Ridge. It's about 15 miles east of Snoqualmie Pass. Several things that I like about it. You have views of three different lakes, Lake Cochess, Clay Elm Lake, and Easton Lake. Wildflowers are out in prime force right now, and this is usually the case for the next couple weeks. And when you get to the ridge top, you get a peekaboo view of Mount Rainier and a great view of Mount Stewart. And basically, you want to go relatively soon, as if you wait till late in June, the flowers are gone and it can get rather hot. And also, this trailhead is the same trailhead for several other hikes, so it's a really good destination. And as far as difficulty in terms of exertion, I've developed a new...
This is my meter, right?
I should call it the Marcy...
Right. Lazy meter. Woman meter.
So one is easy hike, like maybe Green Lake. Five would be a real hard hike. We'll call this a 3.0.
Okay.
7 miles round trip, 2,000-foot gain. So not that difficult. Bring your map and compass. This is Green Trails Map 208. The trailhead is a little tricky to find, so please bring your map again, Green Trails Map 208, and look at the blog for the information on getting to the trailhead.
And now last week, you talked about 10 essential things that people should bring with them on a hike, and you sent the list, so we've got them. Do you want to go over it?
Absolutely, and it's, you know, you think the weather's going to be great and it should be great the next several days, but if you end up turning an ankle and need to stay overnight, you want to be prepared for the worst, if you will. And in our pack, we're really not looking at more than 20 pounds, so you're not loading up your pack to 40, 50 pounds. So you want your map and compass. The second one, sun protection, sunglasses, even though we tend to lose those. plenty of sunscreen. Extra clothing or insulation. You want some lighting system if you do have to stay overnight or if you get in late back to your car, bring a headlamp. Those are really handy. First aid kit in case you get a cut or bee sting. Some people are allergic to bees. You want to be prepared for that. Fire starter, just in case you stay overnight and it's cool and wet, you want to be able to get a little fire going. A repair kit in case you break your pack, so you bring a pocket knife, and duct tape's always handy. Extra food besides your lunch that you bring. I always have some energy bars tucked in the bottom of my pack in case of emergency. And definitely want extra water, especially as we get into the warmer weather like we have right now. And this hike, it's south-facing, so it is it can be warm. So you want extra water, and there's really no water to get to on the ridge top. So you want to be prepared for that. If you're going to hike that has a lake, you can certainly bring a filter. Mm-hmm. And you want an emergency shelter. Space blanket is a nice thing to bring. And again, all these 10 items I listed were should easily fit in your pack and be 20 pounds or less.
And you take that with you this week when you go to Easton Ridge. Michael, thanks so much. And you can find the link to this at Michael's weather and hike blog, hikewashington.net. Michael Fagan with West Coast Weather LLC. His blog, Fagan's Weather World, gives us some good hikes to match the weekend weather forecast. And we're hoping for mostly sunny skies. Thanks, Michael.
You bet.
Bye-bye. And now, the sound of the day. All right. It sounds like pigs, and it is the sound of five young pigs eating dinner. And it must be very tasty. Our listener, Jay, sent us that sound, and I'm assuming, Jay, these are your young pigs.
I wonder what they're eating.
I know, me too. I don't, you know, slop is
pig
what it's...
Pig chow.
Pig chow from Purina. What interesting sounds are you listening to in the world around you? We'd love for you to record 30 seconds of what you hear and send that to us along with the story behind the sound. You can email your audio file to weekday@kuow.org. And please include sound of the day in the subject line so we know what it is. Well, whether it's pigs or hiking or maybe you want to talk about religion, our interfaith amigos are going to be in the next hour. We're also going to hear about why the state of Washington has got its eye on Seattle Public Schools special education program. Our ed reporter, Ann Dornfeld, is going to come in, Bernard. We'll hear about that.
Cool. It's 9:59. Sediment health in Puget Sound is declining. That's according to a new report from the State Department of Ecology. KUOW's Lisa Brooks has more in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Emirates, offering daily nonstop service from Seattle to Dubai and on to over 130 destinations worldwide. More at emirates.com/USA. Fly Emirates. Hello tomorrow.
Medgar Evers was killed for fighting to dismantle Jim Crow. 50 years later, his widow says that sacrifice was worth it.
He did believe in America. He did believe in Mississippi. And he.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.